Good morning, everyone, and welcome to TOC's webinar on racehorse retirement. My name is Elizabeth Morey, and I am TOC's Director of Racing and Northern California Operations. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. We will be conducting a question and answer session at the end of the presentation and also taking questions throughout the seminar. So if you'd like to have a question on a specific topic or ask a question at the end, please go ahead and press *3 on your keypad at any time, and that will put you in the queue so we can take your question. As a reminder, this webinar is being recorded and will be available to review on our website at toconline.com. And it is now my pleasure to introduce our speakers, Madeline Auerbach, Vice Chairman of the CHRB and founder of Karma, and Lucinda Mandela, Executive Director of Karma. Madeline was born in Yorkshire, England in 1944. She moved to the United States as a child and was always fascinated with horses. She was the first introduced to the world of thoroughbred horse racing by her late husband, Jim, and eventually became a part of his small but active California-based racing stable. Currently, Madeline owns approximately 50 horses, both in breeding and racing capacities. She is the founder and former chairperson of the California Retirement Management Account, Karma, a 501c3 funding charity for retired racehorses in California. She served for 8 years as a director on the Thoroughbred Owners of California TOC board and is a founding director of the Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance. Madeline was elected to the prestigious Jockey Club of America in 2012 and in January 2014 was appointed as a commissioner to the California Horse Racing Board by Governor Jerry Brown. She now serves as vice chairman of the CHRB and in 2018 was appointed to the National Racing Museum and Hall of Fame Board of Directors in Saratoga, New York. All the while, she continues to be one of the most active and visible owners on the California West Coast racing circuit. Lucinda Mandela began riding at the tender age of 7. She's a lifelong lover of horses and continued riding and showing competitively until her move to Southern California, where she began a career in the thoroughbred racing industry. A graduate of the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program, Lucinda worked for the Thoroughbred Owners of California for 14 years, heading that organization's successful continuing education program and provided on-track liaison services for owners. In 2011, Lucinda was hired as the executive director of Karma, an organization she helped launch while at the TOC. Karma raises funds and awareness for the care and retraining of California's retired racehorses, and since beginning operations in 2008, has given more than $4 million to organizations that care for off-track thoroughbreds. Lucinda lives in Southern California with her son and their dog, Gunner. Ladies, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You both have given so much to the thoroughbred retirement world. Many of the programs that we have today that we're going to be talking about really are here because of your hard work. But I'd like to know, Madeline, how did you get started in racehorse retirement? Where did this journey start for you?
This started for me when we had the good fortune to have probably California's most successful sire, Unusual Heat. And he was wonderful for California and wonderful for us. And we ended up breeding him quite a bit and having a lot of horses. At one time, we had probably 125 horses, and that includes brood mares and babies, et cetera, et cetera. But we also had a wonderful band of racehorses. And in the first crop, which was 1999, one of our babies was named Lenny from Malibu. And he was named after a doctor, and he was a lovely racehorse who actually had the distinction of for Calbred, doing some amazing things like running 7 consecutive 100-plus buyers, which was pretty amazing. And he was a stakes winner and very accomplished. And when he was getting toward the end of his career, at that time I thought the kindest thing I could do would be to look for a home for him, a nice farm. And I had never considered what happens to racehorses. Where do they go when they're through at the track? And to say I was clueless would be giving me too much credit. I started going out to these farms, looking for farms, trying to figure out what the heck to do, and I stumbled upon Tranquility Farm, and at the time they were up in Tehachapi, And I took a ride up there, and I was aghast at what I found. I mean, the horses looked fat and happy, but the facilities were very basic, and it was like a slap in the face. It was an eye-opener. I went ahead, made arrangements, gave them a nice donation, and decided to put him there without realizing that he probably would have made a great eventing horse. I had no knowledge of any of these things. There was nothing in place to help me figure things out, and I kind of did it all on my own. But I quickly began to realize that with all the horses we were breeding and how many we still owned, where was I going to put them when their careers were over? Like, where do good racehorses and even bad racehorses go to retire? And that really is how we got started. And I realized it had to be a collaborative effort on not just one person at a time is lost in this process. What we have established today is a way to get this done. And that's what we're talking about this morning.
And Madeline, one of the interesting things that you have mentioned to me is that this was not by any means the first horse that you had owned. You had been an owner, in fact, for many years. How many horses would you say that you had been involved with before Lenny?
I don't know the number, but I could tell you the first year we got a horse, was the horse's name was Bravo Bravo, and he was running in Caliente, Mexico, and they brought him here to run. And we claimed him, and this was either, I think this was in 77. And when we claimed him, we brought him here to run. And those of you who are familiar with the claiming game will understand the terminology. We double jumped him. I think we claimed him for $8,500, and instead of going in for $10,000, we went for $12,500. And oh, by the way, this is the reason we got hooked. I don't have to tell you that he won. And this is easy. And that's really how we got started in owning racehorses, because, you know, we didn't have the money to do any of this stuff. My husband loved to gamble on them, and I had told him if he made enough money gambling, he could claim one, and he did. And that was the start of this whole thing. So I don't know the number, but it was many. And it never really occurred to me, because we were always in, not always, but most of the time in partnerships and stuff. And people did things with horses back then. It was all kept quiet. I didn't know. I would hear things like, oh, the pony boy took him, or this one or that one. And I, at that time, had no clue what that meant. Over the years, I began to get interested to find out, to follow them, and was really aghast and somewhat ashamed of us because I didn't know what happened to them. I do now.
Lucinda, Karma just launched a new campaign, awareness campaign, and it's called Own, Race, and Retire. Could you tell me about what inspired that campaign and what it means to you?
Sure. Actually, that Own, Race, Retire came from Madeline. It was something that we were brainstorming about and talking about, what it means to retire racehorses, what it means for owners, what it means for our industry. I think that over the last 10 years, 5 years for sure, but 10 years, the subject of racehorse retirement is something that's in the front of the conversation of racing instead of at the end of the conversation of racing. And so this new campaign really started with Madeline saying, look, we own these horses, we race these horses, we retire these horses. And so the other thing that we came up with, yeah, Madeline just reminded me, is that aftercare is not an afterthought. It's something that is as important as selecting the horses you're going to buy or breed, as, you know, trying to decide which horse to claim. It is as important as the races themselves. It is not an afterthought. So that's really something that this year we wanted to have a conversation about. We wanted to make sure that our community of horsemen was talking about aftercare with the same enthusiasm and the same commitment that they were talking about the other aspects of racing. So that's how it came about, and we love it.
You know, we often hear the phrase, there's no such thing as a free horse. Could you talk a little bit about you know, we talk a lot in our seminars about investing in horses and claiming horses and picking out the right horses to claim, picking out the right horses at sale,
right,
and having a budget for that.
Right.
But can you talk a little bit about, you know, what is the budget to care for a horse?
And sure.
I think it costs the same whether they're a $4,000 claimer or a $400,000 purchase.
It
to
does.
Support them.
Yeah, it does. And I know from my years of working at TOC exactly what the conversations are and the education is for new owners or people considering, you know, joining horse racing as an owner. And there is a lot of talk about and a lot of written material and information on deciding the level and knowing the different levels that you can participate in racing and being mindful of what those levels cost and, you know, really making good, sound business choices when it comes to participating in racehorse ownership. And you're right, there is no such thing as a free horse. They eat the same all the time. Whether they're racing or they're standing in a pasture, they need to be fed, they need to be cared for, they need regular medical checkups, they need to have their feet tended to. You know, there are costs associated with these horses long after they are done racing and they're, you know, not on the racetrack anymore. And I think it's important for people to put into perspective the lifespan of a horse. So our horses are incredibly well cared for. They're well tended. These horses are going to live 25, 30, 30 plus years. Their racing career, we're here and seeing them on the racetrack for 2 to 4 years of that, maybe 5 or 6. If you're lucky enough to have a, you know, we call them those warriors, right, those racehorse warriors that grind it out until they're 8 and do a good job and love to run and are, you know, successful on the racetrack for a long period of time. But often we're talking about horses retiring or finishing their racing career. I don't, retiring from racing, but not retiring to do nothing. But they're finishing their racing career around 4 or 5. So let's just say they retire at 5. We have 25 years of care and expense that we need to plan for that horse. So it's something I think everyone needs to remember that they're not free. They still need to be fed.
What kind of differences do you see in finding homes for horses that are retiring off the track sound versus retiring off the track with a, you know, injury that's going to need some rehab but really not limit their careers, or horses that are retiring with a injury that's going to limit what they're able to
sure.
do in the future?
I think actually one of the great things about having the conversation and being able to talk about thoroughbred aftercare and racehorse retirement so much is that, like Madeline said, you know, she looked for a farm for Lenny to go to live out his life. But in truth, Lenny probably could have gone into a home where he had a different job than racing and been just as successful and active and done all kinds of things and then maybe ended up in that pasture at Tranquility Farm. Not that Lenny isn't happy out there eating grass.
And fat.
And I know we've got some pictures of him. You can see him with his buddy in pasture. He's well fed and happy. But he could have probably done something else. And so when we're talking about racing careers ending and moving on to a second career, we have to consider the reason that racing career is ending. Oftentimes the reality is they have an injury that is going to preclude them from racing again. What I found really interesting working in aftercare all these years is that there are a lot of injuries that preclude a horse from racing that have no other limitations for them. In other words, we can have broken bones and strained tendons, and we can have surgeries that, you know, put bones back together, and those horses can go on and do incredibly active physical things. So I think when you're retiring your horse, you do need to be mindful of the fact that if you've got a horse with an injury, there is going to be some recovery time and cost associated with that rehabilitation. That means that their second career might start a little bit later than a horse that's retiring simply because maybe they're not as competitive as they were.
Madeline, how would you say you have seen the overall awareness across the industry of an owner's responsibility to retire their horses change over the last 5 to 10 years?
I've seen a huge change. I just want to make sure everybody understands that that not every horse that you see at the racetrack is going to go into the aftercare process as some of the others. A lot of the horses at the racetrack will go into the breeding shed and be part of it. And so it isn't every single horse that comes off the track that has to go through the process or through through whatever is available to them. One of the most striking things that I know aftercare has really taken hold of is there's a lot of people who own now because they're part of partnerships and, you know, various groups like Little Red Feather and they're all part of these big syndicates. And about 7 or 8 years ago, it became evident to me because people would call me and ask me questions and things of that nature that they were actually, before they put their money up with the syndicate, they were asking the syndicate, do you have provisions for retirement for this horse, whatever horse we get involved with, whether we buy him or claim him or whatever process we use. And that has become one of the things that has really helped the general awareness of the public who are getting involved in racing, that this is a question that 10 years ago nobody would have asked. They just wouldn't have asked. They wouldn't have known to ask it. Now people understand, hey, if I'm going to join this syndicate and we're going to have parts of all these horses, I want to know what happens to them afterwards. Do we have a fund that we've put together? How active are we in making sure these horses are cared for? If I'm going to be part of this horse's life for 3-4 years, I want to know where he is, what he's doing, how is he, did we help, did we make it happen? So to me, that was a sea change, that even people getting involved on a level where you maybe don't quite feel as close because you're part of a big group and things of that nature, this has become one of the selling points now of a syndicate. We have an active, progressive, caring aftercare program. We're going to take care of this horse. We love him. He's ours. And for as long as he's ours, we're going to care for him. That to me was very telling. I'd never seen that before. And now I haven't called syndicates, so I don't know for sure. But if anybody on the phone is interested in that, it's a very legitimate question.
Absolutely. And that kind of leads into another important concept, which is these horses, especially if they're a claiming horse or in a partnership, they're not necessarily owned by the same ownership group throughout their careers. And there's been a lot of developments in the industry to have people contribute at all levels of ownership, from breeding horses to selling them at sales to racing them throughout their careers. Could you talk a little bit about the TAA and Karma and how they're actually funded through the industry throughout horses' entire careers?
Well, Karma is funded through a purse deduction, which is an automatic purse deduction. It's 0.3%, so it's very small, but it comes from the owners. When you put all those little 0.3% together, it's a lot of money. I don't remember in the last few years, what do we take in, Lucinda, each year approximately?
We average approximately between $280,000 and $300,000 a year in contributions from owners' purses.
And then we get, on top of that, we get matching funds from Santa Anita, from the Stronic Group, from both Santa Anita and Golden Gate, and we get matching funds from Del Mar. They match whatever is put into those accounts, and that money right now at this point in time is utilized for our placement program, where we take horses directly from the racetrack and get them into the system. It, you know, it's like a placeholder to get them into the system till we can find them, get them, you know, calmed down from racing, et cetera, et cetera. That's how Karma works. Plus we do fundraisers, plus we get grants, plus we put on horse shows, plus, we get donations. We've got for example, both times that the Bafferts won the Triple Crown, we got huge donations from them. These are the things that keep us going, because we all have to take care of each other and help each other, because this is a normal expense that people could not bear. Most of us couldn't survive it. So we have to have a community level involvement. The TAA founding is a little bit different. They have gone out and made deals with racetracks to get a start fee, a dollar fee, a $5 fee, a $10 fee that goes to TAA. They had tremendous support from stallions. The stallion support was a percentage of one stud fee. And when the stud fee is $300,000 and you get, you know, whatever percentage they are now getting, and I don't know, it was at one time a quarter of a percent, that's pretty healthy, you know, to get $75,000 at a crack. And they need to, because they deal with the entire country, so the TAA needs that. And there's that. There's they do a lot of fundraising in various areas, like they do what I call, and we do it a little bit too, the bake sale. And the bake sale is something that you do on a smaller level. We try to stay away from that. Both the TAA and Karma try to stay away from that, because when you are funding all of these groups, we're both funding organizations. That's what we do. That's the core, our core business is to give money. When you're funding these groups and you're responsible to see where the money goes and you have to go and look at the place and get their financials and make sure they're within the law and they have insurance and blah, and the ad infinitum, things that they have to do, it's very important that they also fundraise. In other words, there aren't groups that we deal with that, oh, by the way, we fund them completely and they exist. Not even close. We are there to try to help keep the lights on and make sure the horses are fed. But we don't even begin to pick up all their expenses. We're a funding source. TAA is a funding source. We're more regional, although we do fund to Kentucky because we do have a bunch of horses like at Old Friends. And they are national. And we do try to work together. And I hope I didn't confuse everybody, but you can ask me questions later. I've been doing this for a long time, so it comes kind of naturally, and I think sometimes I might skip steps in between, so I apologize if I did.
No, that was great. But maybe, Lucinda, you could talk a little bit about the relationship between Karma as a funding organization and the the aftercare partners that you work with, because one of the things I encounter is owners that maybe have had a personal connection with one of your accredited organizations, like Tranquility Farms, where Lenny from Malibu is, but maybe don't actually understand the relationship between that face and that organization and Karma as a funding group.
Sure. So, as Madeline said, at our core, Karma was created to raise money and give that money away. So we operate a grant program that we fundraise for, and then annually we accept applications. We have a grant period, a window of time, where we accept applications from the Tranquility Farms of the world. So we get applications from organizations all over California. We get applications from organizations in Arizona, in Washington, in Oregon, Kentucky. We get applications from a lot of different places. And we have a committee, and we go through a review process of those applications. And like you would go out and get a grant for an education program you want to do at a school. It's the same kind of thing. So these organizations apply to us for funding. We have a pot of money that we can give away annually. We review all of those applications, have a set of criteria. We do site visits, inspections, so that we visually can see these places and see the horses and talk to the administrators and facility managers. And then we allocate grants, and those organizations become the aftercare charities that we work with for that year. And so we typically have the same core group of you know, charities that we have relationships with, but we get new ones, some drop off, some add, some come back 2 years later. It kind of goes back and forth. And these organizations, I say, I mean, we're all doing the work, but these are the organizations, these are the people and the facilities and the places that are really doing the work of either retiring these horses, giving them a permanent retirement place to live, or retraining them, getting them ready for their second career, their next career. And so these are the organizations that, you know, they've got costs associated with training horses and, you know, getting them ready to be adopted out and that kind of thing.
I just wanted to add, I think we've been a little remiss because we know it so well, to point out that all of the organizations that receive money from CARMA are 501c3s. So they do have a federal license guarantee that they are registered charities. And one of the things we do is make sure that they are up on that. The other thing I wanted to point out as it relates to CARMA funds, we give them funds based on horses that have run in California.
Go ahead.
It just came to my mind that we, while we recognize horses run all over the place and they're not necessarily cowbreds, what we use as our guiding criteria is these horses need to have run in California. And the reason for that is the funding basically comes from the owners and from the purse account. So we want to make sure that the horses actually contributed to the fund that we, you know, are giving the money out for. So it's one of the criteria we use in evaluating who gets what.
Lucinda, approximately how many different charities are you guys going to accredit this year?
We will, in 2018, we awarded, I want to say it was 23 or 24. I could count it up. But at our average is somewhere in that low 20s range annually of organizations that we're awarding grant funds to. And the way we look at it is we don't, CARMA does not technically accredit these grant recipients. That's something actually that is exclusive to the TAA. They are the only accrediting body in the nation for thoroughbred aftercare. And they have a very stringent accreditation process that is actually, it's parallel with their granting, their funding. For the TAA, which is the national organization, and we actually share many of this charities here in California with the TAA. In other words, we're granting to them and the TAA is also granting to them. I'm going to brag for a second. So of all of the charities across the country that the TAA accredits, the state with the most TAA accredited organizations is California. So we have 11 TAA accredited charities that work with thoroughbred aftercare, and that's the most in any state in the country. So that's kind of, we can pat ourselves on the back that we've got a good group, and that should actually be really comforting to owners and trainers out there, that these organizations are at the highest standard, the highest level of service, I want to say, for these horses. They have met so many criteria through that accreditation process that as an owner or a trainer, you can feel some sense of comfort and assurance knowing that these facilities are incredibly transparent. They are adhering to best practices and high standards that have been set. So that's a good thing. But we have anywhere between 22 and 25 a year that we grant money to. And so, does that answer your question?
It does.
I got off on a little bit of a tangent with TAA, but I wanted to be, I want our listeners to understand, for CARMA, we don't have quite that same depth of questionnaire, and
we don't have the staff, and we don't, the TAA accreditation application, most people think they'd rather go through an IRS audit.
Yeah.
It is that stringent.
Really?
It needs to be. It needs to be. Over the years, there have been a lot of people who've gone in and out of business taking care of retired horses, and unfortunately, they haven't always done the right thing. So the reputation of our part of the industry has not always been rock solid. That's done a 180, and it's rock solid now.
Yeah.
Lucinda, are all of these aftercare groups that you work with, are they all, you know, pretty much the same? Do they all retrain the horses and adopt them out,
No.
or do they have kind of different missions?
Yeah, I think that that's one of the great things that we have is that we have a wide variety of types of organizations that are doing the work of thoroughbred aftercare. So we have organizations that are, I call them the brick and mortar permanent retirement facilities. These are places kind of, if you were to say thoroughbred retirement, that would be the picture in your mind with the horses turned out in fields and herds, and they just live outside. Maybe they come up at night or they've got run-in sheds, and they just live out there, kind of as you would expect them to live in a pasture with grass. Maybe not a lot of grass in Southern California, but grass. We then have some organizations that are really focused on retraining and adoption. Their mission is to take these horses in. They have probably a lower number of horses in their herd on average. And those horses, they're working with professional trainers to find out what kind of suitability that horse has and then retrain that horse, get that horse started, and then go out into the rest of the horse world in that larger equine community and adopt those horses out. And then we have some organizations that do a little bit of both. So we've got hybrids that they've got some horses that they've taken those horses on, and after working with them, they realized, you know what? What's the best choice for this horse is to say, well done, good job, deserve a rest, and just let them retire. And they've also got some horses that they take in that they think might be permanent retirees, and a year and a half later, that horse is ready to go. It's just dying to have a job, would love to have something to do or a person that he can or she can belong to. And so we've got some organizations that do a little bit of both.
Do you think since Karma was incepted that these organizations maybe are actually working together a little bit more than they
Yes, I do. I think that when Karma was first started here in California in 2007, 2008, we actually started raising funds, there was a significant amount of concern from those groups that had been doing the work for a while that Karma would take over and replace, I think. They were concerned that there was a new group coming in and that maybe there wouldn't be the same kinds of funds available, or would we be supportive of all of these organizations because there were so many. I think what we've seen over the last 10 years is that we've been able to create our own niche and our own space within the aftercare community, and I've seen them start to work together. I think one of the biggest challenges that aftercare had 15 years ago was that these horses, you know, as we get in further down in the conversation, we talk about what choices are available, that like Madeline said, she didn't know where to go. So she saw a place and she picked it and it looked good. But as we said, Lenny may have been able to do something else. And how great would it have been if at that time that you were retiring him, maybe he did land there for a while, but that that facility and that organization was in regular communication with an organization that only did retraining and adoption. And they were able to talk to one another and say, hey, I've got this horse that he's great in pasture, but he's sound and he is pretty and flashy and he's interested and active with people. He would make a great riding horse. Can we trade for one that you have that isn't going to be able to be retrained? It would have been nice, I think,
absolutely,
if that had happened. What if we fast forward to 2019, we see that happening
quite a bit,
quite often now. We see these organizations talking to one another and reaching out to one another for advice, for support, for resources, for to be able to find a way to maximize the dollars that they're getting and also to maximize the best placement for their horses. Because if an organization in Northern California can trade with somebody in Southern California, or they've got a connection that the Southern California group has two horses that would fit great with that Northern California connection, why wouldn't they help each other to move horses along? Because we've got plenty of them retiring each month off the racetrack that, you know, our placement program is evident. I've got 20 waiting for spaces at these charities. So I do. I've seen a definite improvement in communication. It's nice.
Almost like online dating for retired racehorses.
Yes. If we can just get the two groups talking to one another, amazing things happen.
So you mentioned the placement program, mm-hmm. and that was not originally part of the plan for Karma. That was something that developed later.
Yes,
so could you talk a little bit about how that came to be and what the placement program is?
Yeah, my board is amazing and wonderful, and a couple of people on my board, Madeline in particular, we knew there was a need to do something to provide a service on track. And we had experienced, I think anecdotally, from other racing jurisdictions around the country, some of the challenges and candidly failures of on-track retirement. And so nothing was very successful prior. The idea of having a stall or a stable or a place on track where you could turn your horses over to retire them just was never able to, we never found a place where it was working well. And so I have to be honest, I was dragged kicking and screaming into creating this program. I just had so many reservations and was so reluctant to start it. To me, it was just fraught with challenges and unpredictable people and just, it seemed like it was not going to be a good idea. And this great fear, I think if you work in thoroughbred retirement, you know, we talk about owner responsibility and we talk about how the culture has really changed and talking about aftercare. But, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, we still had battles with people with the idea of what responsible ownership looked like and doing the right thing for your horse. And so I think there was this fear that we would come to work one day and like have 5 horses tied to our office door and like, what do we do? So eventually what we got to was a program that provided a service. And so I think that was really kind of the thinking shift is that we were providing a service to owners and trainers who didn't already have their own resources or connections for retiring their horses. And that if they didn't have those connections, we did have those connections, and we had some funding to be able to do the evaluation and the triage, kind of that 30 to 60 day evaluation period from a horse freshly off the racetrack. And we would be able to safely move that horse from the racetrack into a short rehab period and then on to these charities that we work with and grant money to each year. And that what we heard was from the charities was, it's so expensive for us that first 60 days, that first 30 to 60 days. We have to do x-rays, we have to do diagnostics, we have to figure out temperament, we have to understand the injury, they need critical care, a lot of them, especially if the injuries are fresh. And that it's so expensive for us, if we didn't have that cost, we could take more horses because we wouldn't be spending $5,000, $6,000, $10,000 on that initial rehabilitation. So that was kind of where we started. We said we'd have five horses at a time. We were going to be very small. We would only keep them a maximum of 30 days. And that we would then move these horses on to our aftercare, you know, organizations that we work with. And so we grew.
I'm smiling because I know the program is much bigger than that now.
Yes, the program is much bigger than that. As we moved through this and we realized really what the need was, right? I think the assumption was that something had been happening with these horses prior to Karma starting. They were going somewhere. So I'm not, you know, right or wrong, we assumed that some people had resources for retiring their horses. but we quickly came to realize that the need was large. So currently, our placement program, we serve all of the thoroughbred racetracks in California. We have we're based here at Santa Anita, but we work at Del Mar, we work at Los Alamitos, we work at the Fair Circuit, we work at Golden Gate. Program has, we average 20 horses a month at any given time. We are usually full. We usually have a bit of a wait list. But we move those horses along pretty quickly. And so an owner can reach out to Karma and say that they've got a horse for our placement program, and we have an intake form questionnaire that helps us understand what we need to know about that horse. There's a evaluation process that happens. Talk about the limiting retiring injury if that's the case. And we get veterinary records, diagnostic records if that's appropriate for the horse. There's a $500 donation from the owner to help offset the administration of, you know, taking that horse in and transportation, you know, away from the racetrack. We cover everything. We take care of it, arrange for shipping and transportation. We provide layup for those horses. Our average is about 4 months. That we now have these horses, 4 to 5 months is kind of where we land on average with how long the horses stay in our program. We have some we have for a lot longer than that.
And some for a lot shorter.
And some for a lot shorter. We've had for 4 days. Yeah. And it's amazing. You know, we get a horse, somebody's interested, they give us the intake, we get the donation, we transport the horse to one of our, we have 8 facilities that we work with in the state of California, 2 locations in Northern California and 6 locations in Southern California. And we've had horses move through really quickly where we've got somebody looking for something and that's the horse that fits and it makes perfect sense. You know, the idea with the placement program is to appropriately place them. So we were also looking to solve that issue that these organizations have of an individual calling them up and saying, I've got a horse to retire to your pasture, but the horse is completely sound, he just doesn't want to run anymore, and could go on to do something else in a private home somewhere, instead of being a part of that charity, and that charity having to fundraise to feed that horse every month. Instead, this horse could be adopted out into somebody's backyard or their home, or we have horses that do all kinds of things. So
I just want to add, when we started this, and I'm listening to Lucinda, who was the most opposed person to anything that I have ever tried to do. And
I admitted it.
I know you did. And to hear your glowing report and how hard it was to get this going and how carefully we did it. I wanted to explain to people what we actually did when we first started Karma many years ago. We held what I called a round table, and we invited everybody who did this because we were new at it. We didn't know what the hell we were doing, telling us what their big problem was. And the number one problem that they had was the intake process. About, you know, they are here, they want to take in retired racehorses, but it costs them an arm and a leg. They never got vet reports. Nobody would give them a vet report. Nobody would help them. And it costs them a lot of money. So when we started getting the matching funds from the Stronach Group, who were the first people who stepped up to match the funds, we did not spend the money. We had that money escrowed privately and separately from our other funds. And when I finally managed to get everybody to get on the same page and try to get this done, we had built up a very nice war chest of money, and that is the money that we use to move these horses along. And the most gratifying thing about it, I think, Lucinda, if you would quickly just tell people the story about you had a horse at the show that was one of our original placement horses, and this is what Andra. Was... Please tell everybody how that happened.
So I think this is probably a great way to summarize what the placement program now is, right? And Madeline's right. I'm glowing because we're super proud of this program, and it will be followed nationally.
Somebody somewhere else
in another jurisdiction will replicate this, and that excites me. So we had a horse that we took in. He was a 2013. We got him in 2015.
He's young.
2 years old. Not started. And if you had seen him, you would have understood why. He was enormous as a two-year-old. Huge, big, big horse. He had a left hind sesamoid fracture. It was pretty bad, and they didn't do surgery. So we took him. We gave him more time off. The leg healed beautifully. We finally placed him a year later. So this was on the longer end of us keeping horses. And we placed him with one of the aftercare charities, Hope for Horses, which is in Northern California. And Anita, who runs that program, took her time with him, again, restarting him. And he actually was a handful. You know, by this time, he was just going to be four, and still very young, very green, kind of a big, goofy, dumb gelding that we just couldn't quite make sense of. So she ended up turning him over to a friend of hers who did Western and worked with cows, and Wondura learned how to cut cows. And we all thought, well, that's okay. But great. We love the versatility of the thoroughbred. That's something we talk about in our horse shows a lot. These horses, these animals are so versatile. They can do anything. So there Wondura was in a pen cutting cows in a Western saddle and Western tack. And we thought, well, that's fantastic. And eventually he went along, and the end of this story, I think, is the best part of this story. He ended up being adopted by another friend of Anita's. And she is a hunter-jumper rider. She's a Grand Prix rider, actually, which means she's jumping really high. And we recently concluded our spring Thoroughbred Classic Horse Show at Galway Downs, which we do every year. And Wondura's owner brought him to the Thoroughbred Classic and competed. He competed at our highest level, which is meter 10. This show we ran a meter 15. So they're jumping 4 feet. And I know on the slideshow there are pictures of him. So we've got a picture of Wondura now jumping. And this is her new Grand Prix prospect. So she will take him to high-level shows all across the country and compete with him at that level doing show jumping. So we've got a horse that retired as a two-year-old with a pretty bad ankle fracture, got a lot of time off, learned how to cut cows in Northern California before going on to becoming a Grand Prix show jumper. And I think that is what this placement program is about.
Poster child.
Yeah, absolutely. Wondura is our poster child.
I think this is a great time to remind everybody, if you have questions, please go ahead and press star 3. We've got just a few minutes left, and we want to be able to get any questions in. We'd love to hear from you. This seminar is really intended to be a starting point for the conversation with our membership on ownership. We do not expect everyone to walk away from today being an expert in what to do with their retired horse, because as you both know, it is a process that really is learned over a lifetime of what to do with these horses, and that's why we're encouraging people to reach out to resources of people that are experienced. Could you talk a little bit just about, you know, if you are an owner and you are in the situation that Madeline was in with Lenny, you know, where would you recommend people start?
So I would say visit the Karma website or the TOC website and link to the Karma website. There's a lot of information on retiring your racehorse and kind of the steps to take and things, questions you need to ask on our website. And you can call the office. We've got Natalie and I are both there, and we're happy to answer questions, explain what the choices are, make recommendations on other people that you can talk to, people that have had experience. I think that really just taking the first step and asking the question of, like, what are my choices? What are my options? What kinds of options do I have? You can find them, a lot of them, on our website. All of the organizations that we grant money to are listed there by region, so they all have websites. I would encourage you to read up on these different facilities, you know, find something that maybe speaks to you and or something that you're curious about, and that would be a great place to start.
Right. Going back, you had mentioned the $500 donation for a horse to go into the Karma Placement
mm-hmm.
Program. How would you say that compares to what the placement program expenses on an average horse end up being?
That's a drop in the bucket. Our placement program is a $200,000 a year program. So it's a drop in the bucket. It helps us get the paperwork we need and maybe pay for the van ride, depending on where he's going. So it's small. We gratefully accept higher donations.
And there are people.
And
who
there are.
Give
I
want to
say, yeah, we have
build,
some
build.
Owners that
they give
do.
Us more.
They give us more.
They
They're
do.
So happy
they
to,
get it.
To know that we will be able to tell them where their horse is. And we can tell you where these horses are. We took our first horse in December of 2012. I can tell you where they all are.
That's amazing.
And that's very comforting to most
of
us.
Yeah, I think for the owners listening, that should be reassuring. We know where they go. We keep track.
Okay, and we do have a question here from Rick. So, Rick, you're live. Go ahead and what's your question?
Question is, what would you recommend for a retired broodmare, say, who obviously wouldn't be able to have another career and who perhaps is from a stable that is going out of business and doesn't have the $500 to donate?
Well, that's a really good question.
How old is she?
17.
Yeah, that's tough.
A lot of times... from my experience, and I have a lot of retired broodmares, I don't know what farm she is at. And sometimes when the horses get to that point in their lives, about the only thing you can do is try to work with the farm that they are located. And most farms do have broodmare pastures for the broodmares that have been there for a long time, and get a rate from them. And it will probably cost somebody about $300 a month. And that's just for basic care for feed and maybe a little bit of making sure she gets her shots and the shoeing. But when it's a 17-year-old broodmare, there are no there's no easy answer. Usually that's about the best thing you can do is try to work with the farm and get a rate that you can live with. I hope that helps.
Now, I do know, going back to the conversation about the aftercare groups working together, there was a dispersal in Southern California, and some of the aftercare partners did end up taking on some horses. And I know two of them were not 17-year-old, but younger broodmares, I think about 12 years old, and they ended up at a facility that does permanent retirement. And they really were, as far as anyone could tell, there was no medical history, but they were perfectly sound. And there was another group in Southern California that had a horse in their retraining program that, despite everybody's hopes for him, was not going to end up being sound. And those two aftercare groups actually worked together, and the two broodmares went to the group that did retraining, and the horse that was younger but not going to be able to be ridden went and took their place. And those two broodmares are actually doing wonderful
right.
and going great under saddle and
right.
trail riding and doing all kinds of things.
Yeah. I think to answer that question a little more globally, my experiences and that particular example, that specific example, those are tough placements. It's difficult. An older broodmare, a pensioned stallion, those
Very
are the
difficult.
Kinds of things that are more difficult to kind of tackle. But my experience has been that if, as an owner, you are understanding of what it means financially to care for these horses through that last part of their life when they aren't suitable for adoption and retraining and show jumping and all those fun things. That if as an owner your attitude is, hey, I get it, I understand, and that you're willing to either work with a farm or work with a charity, and ask questions and kind of approach it as, hey, I just want to do the right thing. Here's what I can afford, or here's what my resources are. What do you suggest? And kind of just the tack that you take in trying to do the right thing, I have found goes a long way. That we all get it. Oftentimes you go into these ventures and you weren't really expecting to the end of that career. Now it's like, okay, but I was, breeding and pen hooking, and I don't know now what I'm going to do with aging breeding stock. But by just having, asking the questions and understanding what the commitment is going to be on the front end will get you, I think, a lot of help. The horse community is, we generally want to help each other out. We help to take care of each other. And so having that kind of an attitude with these organizations and with the farms, it really goes a long way.
And I would say I've personally seen that with some of the horses on the track, where people are coming together and between the owner and the trainer and the veterinarians on the track and the aftercare groups, if a horse needs a surgery, mm-hmm. People are getting creative and working together to figure out how everybody can pitch in a little bit to get the horses where they need to be.
Exactly.
It's a different world. It's really nice.
Lucinda, we just have a couple more minutes, but one other project that you took on that maybe wasn't part of the original Karma mission is the Thoroughbred Classic Horse Show. And
yeah.
I know you guys just wrapped up another very successful event last week.
Yeah.
Could you tell us about that awesome program?
Right. So Thoroughbred Classic is our way of raising awareness and our way of promoting the Thoroughbred in sports outside of racing. So this is our way of reaching the horse show community and the riding community to remind them all how great Thoroughbreds are and how athletic they are and how versatile they are. So we host two shows a year, one in March at Galloway Downs, where we do jumping, western, dressage, eventing, so the horses go out on cross country. And then we do a show in December, which is our holiday classic show. We do that at the LA Equestrian Center in Burbank. And that event actually really does connect the horse show world with the racing world. We host a dinner party and have a trainer jockey Calcutta, where we get trainers and jockeys from the racetrack to ride.
And John Sadler is the best.
I know. We get them to ride a little jumper course. And so we've got jockeys, trainers, exercise riders,
really
ex-jockeys riding around on these jumpers. It's a fun evening, and it creates a lot of laughs, and it really does demonstrate how great these horses are because, a lot of these jockeys ride racehorses for a living, but it's a different game when you're going over jumps, and the horses are great. They take care of everybody really well. So it's a fun event, and that program does raise a lot of awareness for the Thoroughbreds and for Thoroughbred aftercare. Really kind of proving that it is not an afterthought.
One thing, just to tell everybody who's listening now, if they happen to go to Del Mar, Karma has its big event of the year, and we did it last year for the first time, and I've never had so much fun at any event. And that was our Hootenanny.
Hoedown for horses.
It's our Hootenanny Hoedown for horses, and you haven't lived until you've seen Dick Mandela and Richie Baltus on mechanical bulls. I can tell you that.
I was there, so, and I can second all of that.
Wasn't
yes,
it wonderful?
It was fun.
And we're doing it again, and y'all come.
All right. Well, we are all out of time. Lucinda, Madeline, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today, and thank you for all the work you've done over the years to provide owners and horses with opportunities through Karma. To our owners on the phone, thank you for calling in. And if you need help finding the websites mentioned today or any other information or resources, please call or stop by either the TOC or the Karma offices. We're all here to help you anytime. So with that, thank you, everyone.